This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 18th, 2010. It's Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, in Haiti, aid workers struggle to deal with delays and challenges as the situation for survivors grows dire. Taliban militants launch a coordinated attack in Kabul outside the gates of the presidential palace. And we'll go to Chile, where after 20 years of center-left rule, voters have elected a conservative candidate as the next president. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Thousands are homeless after religious violence in Nigeria that left more than 20 dead and hundreds injured. Sama Lokoya reports from Lagos.
The violence occurred on Sunday in the northern city of Jos. It started following a minor disagreement over land between a Christian and his Muslim neighbor. The dispute took on a religious tone and then spread rapidly across the city. Christians returning home from Sunday church service said they were attacked by Muslim youths. According to the local Red Cross, some 5,000 people lost their homes in the unrest. The government has imposed a night-to-dawn curfew in the city. The violence is the latest in a chain of religious crises to hit the city, which was once regarded as a good example of how Christians and Muslims coexist peacefully. Tension between Christians and Muslims in Nigeria has been on the rise since the country returned to democratic rule 10 years ago. More than 12,000 people have died in sectarian violence. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Charges against five guards who worked for Blackwater Worldwide, now known as Z Services, were dropped last month by a federal judge who cited violations of their constitutional rights. But the same judge, Ricardo Urbina, unsealed court documents last Friday that include statements by three other Blackwater guards who witnessed the events and described them as unjustified. According to a report prepared by the prosecution and now made public, one of the witnesses said he saw unarmed civilians shot and killed who were clearly no threat to anyone. A sixth guard who pleaded guilty to the charges has already admitted that he fired on the civilians without any justification. With 80% of the vote tallied in the Ukraine, it looks like the opposition leader and former prime minister will meet the sitting prime minister in a runoff next month. Donna Lepidot has more.
The two leaders, Viktor Yanukovych and Yulia Tymoshenko, will face off in second round scheduled for February 7th. Accusations of fraud have been levied by both sides, but there were no reports of major voting problems. The Ukrainian court has banned all rallies in Kiev's Independence Square, where the Orange Revolution took place after the last elections. Critics accuse opposition leader Yanukovych of bringing in hundreds of observers from Georgia to disrupt the election, but the National Election Commission did not accredit them. These elections may change the relationship of Ukraine with Russia. The president of Ukraine, Viktor Yushchenko, says both candidates are in the pocket of Kremlin. Moscow has already announced hopes for better relations with Ukraine, and the EU greeted the electoral process looking forward to a strong relationship in the future. Dana Lepodat, Free Speech Radio News.
Israel's military continues to target anti-wall protest organizers in the West Bank. Free Speech Radio News' Ghassan Banoura reports.
Israeli troops arrested four Palestinian civilians today during a pre-dawn invasion targeting the village of Na'lin in the West Bank. Israeli troops told their families that they have been detained for their involvement in the weekly nonviolent protest against the Israeli-built wall on villagers' lands. In 2004, the International Court of Justice in The Hague ruled that Israel's wall is illegal. The villagers of Bel'in have held weekly protests against the wall for the past 5 years. In the nearby village of Na'lin, protests kicked off 2 years ago. Last week, Israeli troops arrested 3 organizers from the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlement Construction. Also last Friday, Israeli troops used live ammunition to suppress the anti-wall protest in Bil'in. Local activist groups say the military has detained at least 128 villagers in the past 6 months in connection to the weekly anti-wall protests. Currently, Israel's army is holding at least 6 members of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements under charges of incitement against the military. Ghassan Bannoura, Afasaram, Bethlehem.
Amnesty International issued a report today calling on Israel to end its blockade of the Gaza Strip, calling it suffocating for the 1.4 million Palestinian residents who are isolated and struggling with desperate poverty. The group released the report to coincide with the anniversary of the end of Israel's 22-day-long attack on Gaza. Also today, 11 Palestinian human rights organizations have asked Hamas and the Palestinian Authority to conduct internal investigations of war crimes they may have committed during Israel's offensive. Mahmoud Abu Rama is the coordinator for international relations with the Al-Mazen Center for Human Rights in Gaza.
We want to see a committee investigating. We want to have this investigation to be carried out in accord with international law.
Abu Rama adds that the United Nations Goldstone report found that both sides committed violations of international law and called on all parties to investigate. For Free Speech Radio news from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. In Haiti over the weekend, relief workers and civilians continued to save people trapped under collapsed buildings. After more than 4 days buried under debris, aid workers pulled out the owner of the Hotel Montana, one of the most elite hotels in the city, built on a hillside overlooking Port-au-Prince. On Friday, an 18-month-old was rescued by an Australian TV crew. The child's parents reportedly died. Meanwhile, some are using Twitter to get out information about people still trapped under buildings, including Haitian radio DJ Caral Pedre. A tweet Monday afternoon reported, quote, "A lot of students and teachers still alive under the debris of GOC University in Nason." Meanwhile, medics continue to try to treat survivors before they die of their injuries. Dr. Jennifer Ashton is with the United Nations. She said they are still getting new patients with various injuries, from crushed bones and fractures to gangrene and sepsis, when the bloodstream is infected by bacteria.
There are approximately 200 patients here right now, 50% women, 30% children, probably 30% of them are in critical condition. There are a lot of new patients coming in today. It's even busier than yesterday. I can't tell you how many doctors and nurses are here because there's not really a uniform system in place to keep track of medical personnel. There are people leaving, going back to Miami on a steady basis, but there are also doctors and nurses coming in from Miami on a steady basis.
Many of those being treated for injuries have nowhere to go. Vladimir Vicky lived in the Mont Nasa neighborhood. He said he was playing cards when the quake hit.
My home. I can't remember my home. I live on the second floor. The house on the third floor suddenly was falling down. I saw it. That's why I can't remember my house. My wife died. But 2 days later, my brother found my daughter under my house. And she was alive. This is a miracle.
As more bodies are discovered in the ruins, family members and aid workers are struggling to account for and bury the dead. There's a severe lack of body bags, and people have covered the deceased in the streets with anything they can find, plastic bags or sheets. Health experts are concerned that the growing number of unburied bodies poses Haiti's next disaster as disease starts to spread. Meanwhile, humanitarian aid continues to pour into Haiti, but challenges are slowing the goods from reaching those who need them the most. Planes full of aid have been delayed, and vital supplies are stranded on the tarmac, waiting to be distributed. The U.S. military, which is in control of the airport and airspace, says more than 600 planes have landed and taken off in recent days. Haiti's damaged airport typically deals with only 3 flights per day. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
6 days after the earthquake, distributing aid and supplies is still difficult. Both aid organizations and other nations are hoping their planes full of resources are able to land in Haiti's only airport. The U.S. military is in control of the airport and the airspace, and they have increased the number of flights exponentially. A single airstrip used to receiving a mere 3 flights per day is now handling nearly 100. But the demand is much greater. Joseph Moody is a program coordinator for Airline Ambassadors International, an organization that has been doing relief work in Haiti since the 90s. He's also a member of FSRN's elected board of directors.
Yesterday, we chartered an aircraft in which we had 60 Haitian American medical personnel fly in with aid.
But he says another flight scheduled for tomorrow has already been canceled.
We have passengers now or doctors that have already left for Chicago, for instance, for a flight on United tomorrow that will not be traveling now. They're going to be delayed 24 hours. So it's a lot of work.
Part of the work is anxiously awaiting to hear about the status of flights. Doctors Without Borders used Twitter to influence the U.S. military to allow their planes full of physicians, nurses, and supplies to land at the Port-au-Prince airport. And media outlets report that the United Nations and some countries, including France and Brazil, filed complaints with the U.S. military because they say they have no access to Haiti. Jose Ruiz, spokesperson for U.S. Southern Command, says those planes either have already landed or are scheduled to. Though he admits that some planes have been delayed, but says the Haitian government determines what supplies are most needed. Right now, planes with water, food, and medical supplies have priority, he says.
No aircraft that has requested to land into the international Port-au-Prince, the international airport in Port-au-Prince that has aid on it, has been denied their request to land.
The military says each plane gets 2 hours to land, offload supplies, and leave. But other countries complain that the U.S. military is allowing their military personnel in before aid. The U.S. military says they are trying to allow the same number of civilian flights as military flights. Captain John Kirby is a spokesperson for the military's joint task force. He says there are more planes wanting to land than are able to.
We're trying very hard to make an even split between the flow of military flights and civilian flights. And it's roughly 50% for each.
Once the aid is delivered, the very next challenge is distributing it. Aid groups say relief supplies are piling up on the tarmac. USAID, which is coordinating the distribution efforts with the U.S. military, says it's challenging to coordinate all the different groups. Tim Callahan is head of the Disaster Relief Response Team.
I think there obviously has been some challenges in the first 2 days of coordination, but there is a plan in place.
He says over 100 distribution centers, as of today, are working. And they are working with the UN and NGO partners to get the resources distributed. By the end of the day, the U.S. military will have 7,000 service members in Haiti. They are armed, but maintain that their mission is search and rescue and humanitarian relief. There are reports that Haitian police are shooting looters. The U.S. military says they are not working with the Haitian police and are focused on humanitarian relief. Again, Jose Ruiz.
They do deploy with weapons sometimes to conduct their mission, but the focus here is not on weapons. The focus is on helping the people impacted by the storm or impacted by this disaster.
The U.S. says they will stay in Haiti as long as they are requested. They also said they will continue to conduct searches for people through tomorrow, at which time it will likely become a mission for recovery. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The Department of Homeland Security has granted temporary protected status to Haitians living in the United States. The designation means that undocumented Haitians can now apply for authorization to work legally. There are an estimated 30,000 Haitians in the U.S. who have fled natural disasters and extreme poverty, and until this designation, were facing deportation. Immigration advocates had pushed for the move. They say that remittances, money, and support sent back to family members in Haiti is a key element for long-term recovery following last week's devastating earthquake. Here to take a look at how this move could affect the recovery in Haiti and what it means for the broader immigration policy towards Haitians, we're joined by Fritz Gutwein. He's the coordinator of Haiti Reborn and the co-director of the Cahote Center. That's a social justice organization based in the D.C. area. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for having me.
First, let's begin with this status, temporary protected status. What exactly does it permit?
Well, as you said, it allows Haitians who are in this country to live here legally and to work, to pay taxes in the United States, and to send money back to Haiti. That's the key. Those are the three key things that it allows. And it allows that for an 18-month time period. And in the past, temporary protected status has been renewed for populations that have gotten it. So most likely that will be longer than an 18-month period, but it's usually done in 18-month increments.
I see. And the designation is not automatic. Those eligible need to apply, right? So what is the application process like?
Well, they're going to need to apply for two things. Apply for the status period, and Haitians are also going to need to apply for a work permit. The work permit application is about $340. And the other, there's a couple of other application fees going along with temporary protected status itself, which pushes the total pretty close to $500. And that is a little bit of a problem right now because many of the Haitians that are here are pretty close to the poverty line in this country. And in a situation like this where Haiti, the country, needs as much aid as possible and as much remittances as possible coming back from this country, from Haitians that are working here, we would like to see those application fees waived so that there can be more money and cash in the hands of Haitians who will most likely be sending a good deal of that back to their country during this time of crisis.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano said in a statement, she emphasized that this only applies to Haitians who are here as of January 12, 2010. She advised others not to leave Haiti. Those who do leave will be, quote, repatriated. How does this fit into the broader U.S. policy towards Haitians over the past few years?
Well, it fits right in with what their fears have been and with what the immigration policy has been. This country has really never allowed economic refugees, and that is what they have thought of as what kind of the classification they have put Haitians in is that they're fleeing an economic environment. And we really have not allowed that in this country. So that fits very well with what the policy has been. The immigration community and the Haitian community has thought for a long time that the disasters in Haiti, the natural disasters and the political climate there has been such that people did need to flee and deserved temporary protected status here, but the government has not seen that until this catastrophic event. This is a victory for immigration rights and for the Haitian community, but it's really a hollow victory given the magnitude of the disaster that had to occur for the Department of Homeland Security to change its mind.
And finally, what's going to be needed for long-term recovery for the people of Haiti? What role can family members in the U.S. play, and what does immigration policy have to do with it?
Well, one of the reasons that temporary protected status has been something that was really sought after is that between 20 and 30% of Haiti's gross domestic product comes in the form of remittances from abroad. And when there's more Haitians working in the United States legally and are able to send money back, that portion of the GDP will increase and it can help the country itself recover. So that is one thing that family members can do here in the States. The other thing that family members can do is to invest in Haiti itself and to have appropriate development opportunities for them to invest in so that Haitians have more of a control of their own economic destiny rather than multinational corporations in the U.S. or governments outside of the U.S. And the rebuilding effort is really going to need to focus on rebuilding Haiti as an independent country and rebuilding it as a country with investment from Haitians.
We've been speaking with Fritz Gutwein of the Quixote Center about changes to immigration policy for Haitians in the U.S. and what it could mean for the long-term recovery of the country. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Today, Taliban militants launched a coordinated strike against both public and government targets in the heart of Kabul. It's one of the largest assaults in the capital since the Taliban were removed from power in 2001. FSRN's Mujahid Jawad reports.
Taliban militants, including some with suicide vests and racket grenades, stormed government and civilian buildings in the Afghan capital on Monday, as some members of President Hamid Karzai's new cabinet were being sworn in. Gunmen first entered Karisame shopping mall in the heart of Kabul close to the presidential palace and started firing from every side. When Afghan security forces got to the area, they started exchanging fire. One massive explosion occurred near the entrance to the presidential palace at 10 a.m. local time, in another in Pashtunistan Square. Moment later, a third blast happened in front of the Gulbahar shopping center. A fourth blast was heard near the Palmer Cinema, followed by a fifth explosion in the Khairhwa market. The Taliban also targeted the ministries of finance and justice, as well as the high-security Serena Hotel, where many foreigners are living inside. The streets of Kabul were chaotic, as this eyewitness explains.
We saw two policemen and two shopkeepers who were killed and lying on the ground. Many shopkeepers were trapped under the ground floor of the market. First, four masked men with heavy machine guns and bullets entered the market and told us, "If you like death, stay here." Suddenly the shooting started and the situation deteriorated and we escaped.
By early evening, Afghan officials claimed they had the violence under control. Mohammad Hanif Atmar is the interior minister. He said five people were killed, including three law enforcement members, while 71 others were injured, including 35 civilians. He also said that some of the attackers were foreigners.
Number one, we don't train suicide bombers in Afghanistan. There is no school for training suicide bombers in this country. These are sent out to us to kill our innocent people. Number two, while I will wait for further investigation and the result of that investigation, already there are signs that some of these attackers were not Afghans.
He also said that seven Taliban militants were killed in today's violence. The Taliban has claimed that 20 militants took part in the attacks, which some say is the largest coordinated attack in the fortified Afghan capital since the collapse of the Taliban regime in 2001. President Hamid Karzai condemned the terrorist attacks. Mujahid Jawad, FSRN, Kabul.
Chileans went to the polls Sunday in a runoff election to determine the next president. Conservative candidate Sebastián Piñera has won and will succeed the center-left government of President Michelle Bachelet, the country's first female head of state. As FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports from Santiago, the country moved to the right after 20 years of center-left rule.
Billionaire business mogul Sebastián Piñera won Sunday's runoff election with a narrow 2% margin over Senator and former President Eduardo Frei. During his acceptance speech, Piñera continued with his campaign theme of hope and better times.
It has been a great day for Chile. Today, a strong and clear majority of Chileans have spoken. It spoke with strength, it spoke for change, the future, and hope. I want to tell all Chileans to lift your hearts because better times are coming for Chile.
The last time Chile democratically elected a right-wing president was in 1958. Piñera's win also ends 2 decades of power for the Concertación Center-Left coalition. Losing candidate Senator Eduardo Frei praised the open, free, and fair democratic process. He added that progressive forces will unite to protect the achievements of the past 20 years.
I hope that open dialogue and consensus building remains. Also, all of our social achievements and liberties that took us a long time to recover and became a symbol of our relationship with the world. I hope that the public interest and common good prevails.
Some are concerned with Piñera's vast business interests. He owns LAN Airlines, Chile's flagship airline with interest not only in Chile, but also in Argentina, Peru, and the U.S. A LAN subsidiary was recently charged in U.S. courts for price fixing. Piñera also owns a television network. He has interest in private health and education enterprises. And he has investments in banking and private pension fund providers. Piñera takes office March 11th when he is handed the reins of power by outgoing president, socialist Michelle Bachelet. Jorge Garretón, FSRN, Santiago.
With the spread of online media, finding out what happened today is only a click away. But finding media that can provide understanding and perspective about the news is far more rare. Since 2000, Free Speech Radio News has aired on-the-ground reports from all over the U.S. and the world, and we have connected the dots to show the global connections in the news. Whether we're explaining policy maneuvering in Washington or army maneuvering in Pakistan, FSRN makes the connections that help you be a citizen of the world. Your support of FSRN goes a long way to help keep this in-depth news coverage coming. Visit FSRN.org to learn more about how you can help. And today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We close with an excerpt from Dr. King's speech on April 4, 1967, in which he makes the case against the Vietnam War and war throughout the world, and argues for wisdom, justice, and love.
Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
That was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking about the Vietnam War at Riverside Church in New York on April 4, 1967. And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Today's headlines editor was Nell Abram. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at FSRN.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments at FSRN.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doran Marina.